Hi, everyone. I'm David Culver, Vice President of Government and Stakeholder Relations here at Canopy. Welcome back to Under the Canopy. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Congressman Earl Blumenauer to the Canopy team. Congressman Blumenauer has been serving in the United States House of Representatives since 1996. He's a senior member of the House Ways and Means Committee and chairman of the Trade Subcommittee, where he most recently played an active role in passage of the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Agreement. Most importantly to us, though, he is the chairman of the Congressional Cannabis Caucus, the first caucus dedicated to reforming cannabis laws in the United States. He has been on the front line of cannabis policy in the United States, not just during his time in Congress, but going back to his days in the 1980s on the Portland, Oregon City Council. And for all the Canopy Growth cyclists, including myself, I would be remiss if I did not mention that the congressman is also the leading advocate for the bike riding community. So we thank him for that as well. I'm excited for you all to meet Congressman Blumenauer, Under the Canopy, of course. Please enjoy the discussion.
David, it's great to spend some time talking to you about one of my very favorite subjects in the world, how we deal with ending the failed prohibition of cannabis, unlock the opportunities for the private sector, for individuals in terms of health, recreational use, research, and be able to establish a strong legal market. This is key to being able to deal with all of the supposed objections that people have. By legalizing, taxing, regulating, we can make sure that we get the benefits of a new era in terms of the economy. It is huge in terms of justice reform, and being able to get the federal government oriented in the right way, because we don't want to have areas of black market or problems where it gets in the hands of children. And it's all revolves around getting our policies right.
Well, we're so grateful to you just as chair of the Congressional Cannabis Caucus. You've been a leader on this for decades. And I think you hear, I hope you hear from the industry. I will tell you specifically myself just how grateful we are for everything that you do. There's not a member of Congress that I don't talk to about this issue that doesn't reference you and your contact with them. So you're our champion up there, and we're really grateful as an industry.
I appreciate the feedback. Let me just say, after having worked on this for decades, I feel better about what's going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months. The table is set. We've got momentum moving in our direction. And I think we'll finally be able to get it right with a new Congress and the new administration. And it's still possible that we can see some action yet in this Congress.
Yeah, so let's get into that a little bit more. What specifically do you see happening, you know, in the fall, most likely, right? That we could see. Obviously, we've got I'd love your comments about the Safe Banking Act and kind of where that stands as, you know, part of the COVID relief package. And then whatever else you think might happen this fall.
Well, what I've been doing with our operations is basically put on a full court press to take advantage of these seeds that have been planted. And in some cases, we're watching mature action. The Safe Banking Act was landmark on so many levels. I mean, first of all, the notion that we have state legal cannabis enterprises paying thousands of dollars of their taxes with shopping bags and duffel bags full of $20 bills is insane. Not allowing a growing part of the economy to have a full range of banking services, and then having gray areas where we have challenges for people being able, even in their private activities that aren't related to the cannabis business, having negative consequences. The Safe Banking Act moving through the Financial Services Committee on a bipartisan basis, passing on the floor of the House with every Democrat but one, and about almost 40% of the Republicans is a huge milestone. So that's over in the Senate, and it's ready to break loose. There are internal challenges there with people who have, you know, different attitudes. But as a practical matter, I think there is a recognition by some of our friends in the Senate that this is time. And when we have a broad array of stakeholders, not just the cannabis industry, but credit unions, the American Banking Association, people who are concerned with real estate, we've got a great coalition coming together to move that. And so it's going to solve a major problem for state legal cannabis companies and enterprises, but it's also symbolically, in terms of having this first major piece of legislation move through, I think is going to send shockwaves. We also have teed up and ready to go the MORE Act. That's been just a delightful project this last year. Jerry Nadler and I kind of joke, he's been involved with legalization of aspects of cannabis almost as long as I have. I started as a child legislator in 73. Jerry was involved with the decriminalization in New York in the 70s and has never really abandoned his interest. As chair of the Judiciary Committee, it's been great to work with him on the MORE Act that put together the pieces of legislation that we've been working on for a year to try and make the best possible piece of legislation. Build on our experience, incorporating, for example, some of the provisions of Barbara Lee's Cannabis Justice Act. This is an important part of what we're seeing now in terms of the turmoil surrounding law enforcement, racial justice, equity in correct criminal policies. This is something that I think might well be part of a racial justice package yet. This is legislation that passed out of the Judiciary Committee with bipartisan support and is teed up and ready to go. The MORE Act solves one of the major problems we have now in terms of justice for people of color. It's a sad but well-known fact that they are subjected to selective enforcement of outmoded cannabis laws far more frequently than Caucasians. The official statistics are about 3.6%, but as a practical matter, there are parts of America where it's 6, 8, 10, 12, 16 times or more. The selective enforcement has damaged the lives of over a million young Black Americans. Yep. Just this week in the Washington Post was a story about a veteran traveling from his home in Phoenix to visit family in North Carolina who stopped in Alabama for gasoline. And evidently his sound system was too loud and it attracted the attention of a deputy sheriff or a local police officer who came over to harass him for violating their noise ordinance and found marijuana. This gentleman, this veteran, this disabled veteran produced his card demonstrating that this was legally prescribed in Arizona as medicine. Didn't matter to them. There was no use, there was no sale. He is facing 5 years in prison for simply having possession of what in his home state was medicine. We just simply need to incorporate this in our justice reform and why I think there's a real opportunity to do so. It solves a whole array of problems.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Alabama is so tragic, and I agree with everything that you've just said there. I guess just to dive a bit deeper, I was a little surprised in the policing reform package in the House bill that there wasn't more discussion about decriminalization. I'm not obviously there, but I just thought that that may have been part of the package. Is the caucus thinking that maybe this is something that they address later on? Was it discussed during that time period? What was the insider scoop there, Congressman?
Well, a lot of this package was assembled by the Congressional Black Caucus. And there's some residual tension dating back to Ronald Reagan, dating back to Richard Nixon's war on drugs. And it has a complex set of interrelationships. There are some leaders in the Black Caucus, like Charlie Rangel, who were deeply concerned about the impact of crack cocaine on their neighborhoods. And they were, to say the very least, ambivalent about legalization. That has held up some of the activity, for example, in states like New Jersey. And that's being sorted out. But we have not given up. I have taken this message to the Democratic leadership. I've been in consultation with leaders in the Black Caucus who understand the devastating impact that criminalization of cannabis has had on young Black men in particular. And so it wasn't ready to be part of a consensus document, but there is real momentum. There's understanding that this is important. The leadership in the House of Representatives has voted with us on our amendments, has voted with us on the Safe Banking Act. They're open to moving the MORE Act. And we haven't given up. We're moving forward on a number of different levels. I think that can happen yet this summer.
Good. Well, it's exciting. There's so much momentum right now. Let me just pivot to the presidential. And everybody had their eyes on the Biden-Sanders task force recommendations that came out recently. And I know from a number of the folks that served on the task force that they spent an unusual amount of time focusing and discussing the cannabis position. What did you think about the recommendations? What should we do with them? How should we be talking to the Biden campaign? How are you talking to the vice president about this?
Well, I have, as you know, Dave, made this an issue that I've taken to Democratic leadership. I had individual conversations with Hillary Clinton on two different occasions. I went to their headquarters in Brooklyn. I talked to the political people. I talked to the fundraising people. I talked to the campaign elements, the policy people. And in all of those areas, I made the case that this should have been a no-brainer for Hillary Clinton. I know actually that I got through to her, at least in terms of making my case, because some of the hacked emails of John Podesta were records of her conversation with me. But she never really fully embraced it. I will go to my grave convinced that if she could have put together a coherent, rational position on legalization of cannabis, she would have been president. She wouldn't have to worry about 78,000 votes in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And I think the vice president's position is evolving. I think the campaign needs to embrace it. It is demanded by the American public. It's no longer controversial.
Yeah.
Or the campaign to talk about decriminalization is essentially meaningless. Your grandmother's for decriminalization. Over two-thirds of the American public supports full legalization. A majority of Republicans support full legalization, and an overwhelming majority of young people. So I think that's where we're going. I'm optimistic that before the election, we'll get a better statement. But ultimately, what's going to matter is what we do in Congress, and we are poised, maybe even this Congress, to fully legalize, but certainly in the next Congress.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And let me ask you just from a government relations professional perspective, we talk to other MSOs. I talk to them on a regular basis. We have all sorts of different working groups and coalitions, including the one that Amber runs for you very effectively on the Hill. What can the industry be doing to help further this cause? What sort of message can we bring to them from you and from your leadership position on the Hill about how we can support the efforts this year?
Well, let me just say one of the reasons we're in such a strong position now is because of how effective the industry has been, first and foremost, in starting these businesses, running them in a very professional way, being the, in many cases, these are the gold standard in terms of local employment and how they treat their employees, being involved with public education. The industry has helped position us on the verge of final victory. What I think is important is to continue with the outreach, letting people understand what is going on in terms of state legal cannabis enterprises, inviting people in to tour facilities, to meet with their employees, to talk to customers. Mm-hmm. That has made a huge difference in expanding the horizon of policymakers and creating the opportunity for us to move forward. The industry is being much more sophisticated in terms of politics. I got deeply involved in the last series of congressional elections. I formed a little cannabis fund. Nobody got money from me or campaign advice until they had a chance to talk through with me the critical role that cannabis can play and why they need to embrace it politically as well as policy-wise. We removed from Congress the number one enemy of the industry, Pete Sessions, who had an extraordinarily powerful position as chair of the Rules Committee for the Republicans, who was just stymieing us at every turn for no good reason other than his hostility. Well, what happened is we were able to mobilize support for Colin Allred, who wasn't just a former professional football player and civil rights attorney and all around good guy. He had good policies regarding cannabis, and it made a difference in that election. So politics, how people run their business, and then continuing the outreach to the media. I think it's a full court press. All of those things play a role. And I hope that we'll continue beating the drum with individual members of Congress and candidates so that we build more public support to be able to get it across the finish line. These efforts are making a difference, and attitudes are changing, not just with the general public, which has been revolutionary, but it's making a difference in the halls of Congress.
Congressman, you are chair of the Trade Subcommittee on the Ways and Means Committee. I'm just curious if you have put any thought into a post-legalized world, even just here in North America, between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, as it would relate to trade between the three countries. Also curious, too, if you have any thoughts related to the WHO recommendations to the United Nations. I know that you were at the UN last year discussing that matter with leadership. Just curious if you have any thoughts about that particular, those recommendations and the vote in this coming December.
I have been excited about working on in the last couple of years deals with the international aspects of cannabis. In 2019, I went to the United Nations for kind of their interim discussion on international drug policy. I chair the Trade Subcommittee for the Ways and Means Committee. And we have some interesting opportunities in terms of cannabis in the marketplace, interstate and intrastate. We now have in North America, the potential of a North American cannabis zone. Canada has fully legal, and of course, you folks have been pioneers in that. Mm-hmm. Mexico has gone fully legal. And we're watching the momentum build for the same thing in the United States. Having a North American unified market gives opportunities for product development, for research, for meeting the needs of customers in a way that I think is really exciting. And in terms of intra-trade in the United States, as soon as we can get legal, having an opportunity to trade cannabis across state borders. One of the problems we have right now, getting rid of the black market, in terms of the success of various companies. We have a cannabis imbalance. I come from a region that produces an awful lot of high quality cannabis, recognized internationally, but there's a surplus and there's no easy way to dispose of it. And it invites some people to be involved with the gray market. When we can trade that across state lines, we can balance supply and demand. It's better for the industry, it's better for consumers, and it is better for law enforcement. And those objectives in terms of a North America cannabis zone and being able to freely market cannabis across state lines are some of the first things we're going to do when everything is fully legal. And I hope that happens within the year.
Well, I can guarantee you that from Canopy's perspective, we'll continue to keep the pressure on and certainly follow your lead on all of this stuff. I know that we're about out of time here, but I wanted to end with two quick questions if I could. Number one, is do you have any thoughts or comments or inside baseball on who the vice presidential pick will be for Mr. Biden? And then number two, and probably most importantly, we both love bikes so much. I could not have a moment with you without asking, have you been on your bike? Have you been out riding? I know I have. It's been kind of, it's been my saving grace, I think, the last 4 months.
Yeah. It actually, it's been, in terms of cycling, it's been a delight. And I just bought my 7-year-old grandson a new bicycle, and that's something we can do socially distant. Yeah. And it, as we are kind of sentenced to our homes with all these Zoom calls, getting out, biking, and running makes all the difference in the world with mental health.
Yes.
I will say. I am intrigued with a number of potential candidates to be vice president. But my personal hope is that Vice President Biden starts to announce his cabinet selections. I think having every 3 or 4 days announced another cabinet position would help build momentum, would help broaden the base, because he has an opportunity to have all the spectrum of the Democratic Party actually to make some strategic Republican appointments that have been the hallmark of every other administration in my lifetime, except the Trump administration, who don't seem to understand how to do anything on a cooperative bipartisan basis. Being able to make those appointments public will build excitement, build momentum, and provide a stark contrast with the placeholders, the old white men in the Trump cabinet. Half of them appear to be acting and apologizing for Trump, as opposed to being able to get a wide array, perhaps of some former presidential candidates, leaders in the Senate, gubernatorial, and business. I think that would really build momentum and excitement and be a powerful contrast with a just simply floundering Trump administration.
Well, I appreciate that insight. And thank you again for taking the time with us. I always love listening to you. And again, just to reiterate my thanks to you for your leadership for our industry. We're genuinely grateful. And I hope you and your family continue to stay safe, and hope to see you in person at some point, maybe even on a bicycle.
Great. That would be terrific, Dave.
All right, sir. Thank you.